Hey everyone, it's time to kick off another exciting edition of our DevOps Office Hours. It's August 23rd, 2023. My name's Eric Osterman, and I'll be your host. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse helps teams conquer AWS using our rock-solid Terraform blueprints. Whether you're starting from scratch or just not satisfied with your current setup, book a session directly with me by going to cloudposse.com/quiz. Again, cloudposse.com/quiz. Answer a few quick questions, and we'll have a call to show you exactly how your team will succeed. For those of you new to the call, the format's very informal. Our goal is to answer your questions. If you're curious about Cloud Posse or any of our open source tools and modules, this is a great place to ask. For those of us joining through the podcast or YouTube channel, we host these calls every week. Our call today is recorded. So please, if you want to support what we do over here, hit those like and subscribe buttons. Go over to youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse. You can register for these live and interactive sessions by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. So with that said, let's dive right in. Let's see, I have a number of announcements here. So last week was pretty much dedicated to the new initiative, OpenTF. So if you haven't been following what's going on there, keep an eye out. I'm sure there's some exciting announcements around the horizon relating to OpenTF. If you haven't already signed the manifesto, go to opentf.org. Again, opentf.org. Read through there and see if it's a good fit for you either as an individual or get permission from your company to add your name to the list. There is a official logo now for OpenTF. I rather like it. I think it's pretty clever. It's taking inspiration from Terraform and some of its foundations, and it combines the TF aspect, but it's entirely open, an outline of Terraform. So that's the logo. Let's see. Next announcement is from Cloud Posse. We have a we've been starting to add change logs for our components as a way of better communicating updates. You kind of got to fail fast in the beginning, but then as adoption increases, it's very painful if you don't communicate what's changing from release to release. So now when you look at any given component, if there are significant changes, possible breaking changes, we talk about that in the change log. That's also reflected if you go to the repository itself. And it's just embedding the change log from the markdown. If you look at any of our groups of components that are designed to work together, for example, Transit Gateway, it consists of three different components used together. When those change as a collection, there'll also be a related change log of that describing what's affected and the summary of the changes and how you do the, perform the manual migration steps between those. Standard stuff that you see in most open source projects. And we also are about to release a global, right now it's called Upgrade Guide. It's not going to be called that. We're going to rename it. I think we'll have that ready for next week, but it's going to be a global change log of everything going on in our component infrastructure. So it's easier to understand the relationship between changes going on. Someone shared in one of my posts on LinkedIn, I forget exactly what it was talking about, but it was the first I'd been introduced to the new Google Artifact Registry, which is pretty rad. They've deprecated, true to Google fashion, they've deprecated their Docker registry, but they've replaced it with actually something better. So the Artifact Registry, which supports, I believe, pass-through caching of all of these things. At least pass through caching of Docker. I don't know about the other ones, to be entirely clear. But the fact that it supports lots of the most common types of mechanisms for artifact storage is nice. The remote repos is nice. For example, if you're using Terraform, or soon OpenTF maybe, you might need a place to store a permanent artifact or repository of the modules you depend on. Then maybe artifact repository could work for that, or artifact registry could work for that. Anyone on the call using artifact registry can speak more in detail about it. Nope. All right. Another one. We talked about some of these upcoming features in Kubernetes 1.8, for example, first class sidecars, which can be used for things like a service mesh. This is a great write-up on the new stack, breaking down all the features, if you want a summary of that. Also exciting, we've been using Kata for, I guess, about 6 months now in client engagements, and really excited about it. It is a totally pluggable auto-scaling controller for Kubernetes. It has now graduated the CNCF and is a full-fledged project. Kata, what is the, it's kata.sh, if I remember. Yeah. So this is just the number of integrations it supports. So you can configure auto scaling on your deployments or jobs or lots of different things within the Kubernetes cluster. Pretty much every mainstream open source project. I came across another Terraform graph visualizer. This one seems pretty nascent and still needs some help, I think, making these graphs, you know, actually usable. These programmatic graphs, you know, they're well intentioned, but I think, even zooming in here, I don't think you can still see what's going on with this. There's a art and science to communicating the right amount of detail. Anyways, good that somebody's working on it. Another one, another project. I didn't see specifically any differentiators between this and some of the other ones. Personally, I'm excited about the GitHub Actions for Mermaid. I think it was called like TF Mermaid Action. Yeah, I think this one's cool. So it can generate a mermaid markup that works in GitHub natively in your README. So it is a scalable graphic that you can interact with. Another one trending on Reddit that I thought was interesting was, you know, during development time, you might be targeting resources, you know, when you're not practicing GitOps for everything else. This was a pretty nice little script for auto completion to make targeting very easy. And the source for that was also provided. I didn't check to see what shells it supports. This says PowerShell, Bash RC. So it looks like Bash and maybe PowerShell. Finally, this was a real shocker to me. I just saw this a few minutes before office hours. I didn't realize Chris Nova had passed away. She died from a climbing accident. Pretty tragic. She was a prolific open source contributor. Lots of at the forefront, a lot of cool things going on in Kubernetes. The other thing is, she was also a good representative of, in a male-dominated industry, a woman in our field. So that also is sad. Anyone else have anything to share about this more?
I didn't know her and had never worked with her, but I can say a lot of people that I do know and interact with regularly on Twitter and some other platforms, or X and some other platforms, have had a lot of really nice things to say about her. So it sounds like she'll be sorely missed in the community.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I was trying to remember the one, a couple of the projects that really stood out to me, but I'm just totally blanking right now. I know I came across them frequently in the past. All right. Those were my announcements. Anything interesting going on in AWS land or elsewhere? Let's see here. Looks like Vlad maybe shared something in the chat. I'm expanding. Yep. Relevant news. Dedicated local zones. Oops, this is not opening in the right window.
Yeah, this was interesting to me because now you can get a dedicated local zone from AWS. So they started with servers. They then moved to public local zones. And now you can have your own data center managed by AWS with AWS hardware and APIs and stuff.
Wow, they've come full circle, really. That's what that means.
I mean, it was clear that they were aiming for, and they do have very comprehensive tooling for hybrid workloads, regardless of what 37 signals and other dumb people say.
Tell me how you really think.
Does one of these local zones cost like 7 or 8 cents an hour? You get the whole thing?
Pricing is not public for this. If you want a final pricing, call them. And the customers, they have a blog post for this, and the customer is the government of Singapore or something.
Oh.
It's not going to be cheap.
Yeah.
The largest outpost is what? 750K? Something around there, depending on the region.
I didn't follow that. The largest outpost is 750K.
Yeah, I think the largest single outpost rack, I think, it's less than a million in most regions, but I could be wrong.
A million what? I didn't follow. Okay.
Can you do hourly on the outpost?
Nope. Okay. Well, there is some minimum capacity you have to buy, and then you do have some flexibility around that. But chat with AWS about it. And they also have the outpost rack is the big rack you need to install in a data center, and it must have this type of power and whatever. But they also have 1U and 2U racks that you can definitely put under your desk or wherever. And those are relatively cheap.
I'm going to order one right here from my desk.
Just put it on the card.
Sounds good.
I was going to say, do you think, have other clouds preceded this move, or do you think other clouds are going to be quick to follow this?
They all have some sort of this. Google has Anthos or whatever, but these are not really comparable solutions, just like how regions are not comparable. When was it? A couple months ago or half a year ago, we had the Google Paris region get flooded and all their AZs were down because there was water leakage in a single data center. And people were like, oh my God, not all clouds have AZs separated by at least I don't know how many kilometers and using different electricity providers and network providers and la-di-da-di-da. So it's really, really hard to compare them. But all clouds have some support for hybrid workloads.
Well, I can say my son played in a soccer tournament in the Richmond, Virginia area. So while we had nothing to do, one day I took a driving tour of as many US East 1 locations as I could find, and they were they seemed to be really really well spread out, and and geographically dispersed. So clearly not everyone is doing that. And this, by buying this rack, you're not going to get US East 1 like dedicated to yourself by any means. Yeah. I don't know. So the interesting... Oh, sorry. I was just going to say one quick thing just on this is that the interesting thing about this model is that of everyone that we know, IBM will probably tell you they've been doing this forever because this was the IBM like IT outsourcing model. Like IBM managed services would come along. They would sell you a whole bunch of hardware to stick in your data center, and then they would provide you with IBM engineers to run it and manage it and make sure all your workloads run and you control your application on top of it. And that's been starting like in mainframe days, that's been going back for like, you know, 60 years or something that IBM's been in this business. So it's kind of funny how it's come full circle. They're not the only ones, but like Dell did that for a while and other IT outsourcers do it with partnerships with hardware vendors. So it's pretty interesting.
Amazon also has a dedicated cloud department. Where was it? In this spring, they made a classified region in UK for their intelligence services because it started appearing in SDKs and stuff. And people were like, oh, Amazon has dedicated clouds. Like all providers work with you on this.
When the price is right.
When you're a first world nation and you want your own private cloud and you have virtually unlimited budgets, I'm sure you can get anything you want from these kinds of companies.
There was a reInvent talk like 5 or 6 years ago where I think the director of the CIA for the US shared how they basically worked with AWS, got the equivalent of what sounds like the EU did. Or the UK, I forget what was mentioned. Well, but
that's why GovCloud exists. Like GovCloud is just a mirror of basically what the different agencies within the US have as like their own private cloud, like running on AWS.
I believe my understanding of that reInvent talk was they actually got their own private cloud behind CIA firewalls.
That's actually what I'm saying. So they took all of the work they did with that and they basically like cloned it, clone stamped it, and that is what became GovCloud, basically.
Got it.
Yeah, that's how they came to that whole thing.
Yeah, I don't believe we've talked too much in the past about Oxide computers. I think it's more evident now what they're coming out with as more has been talked, but has anyone been following this closer and wants to share what Oxide is doing?
I also do a bunch of hybrid workloads with customers, so I've been following them. Haven't used them, just want to make that clear. But they are the newest and pretty much the only next-gen player in the area. So what they do is they build servers, like that's it, but they build modern servers in the sense that not only they put in a nice API on top of it, but also like a control plane and mature services on there, like EBS equivalents and stuff like that. And they package it all nicely. So they manage, it's the Apple of servers. They manage both the hardware and the software. And the integration looks really, really nice. They seem very powerful. They had their first delivery a couple months ago, a month ago. I know, something like that. So they're super, super new. But they're, besides like Super Micro, Dell, and all the classic players, Oxide is, as far as I know, the only company that is actually trying to do this. And they are fixing a lot of the issues in the industry. Like, good luck ordering a server, and you're going to find out how terrible the BIOS updates and microcode and... everything is, and Oxide is genuinely innovating here and is very customer focused, and there I can foresee a future where some companies have like an Oxide rack in, I don't know, bigger countries or in a branch in, I don't know, the Amsterdam office or whatever. It's interesting. Again, didn't use them, but I like what they're doing, and the feedback that I've heard about them was all very positive.
Yeah, so somewhat tangentially related to this, I back, I don't know, about 10, 15, almost 15 years ago, 10 years ago, I don't know. I was the CTO of this company called IO Data Centers that we built. We built a bunch of data centers in Scottsdale, Arizona, and then they built them out here in New Jersey and a few other things. And then they eventually took all the proprietary work that it takes to build like a data center and figure out like the optimal way to do that, and spun out a company called Baselayer that basically makes modularized data centers. So you can buy like a data center in a cube, and you scale it to the size that you want, and they'll roll up like building blocks that you can assemble together and just connect to external power, basically, and build out like as many of the footprints, you know, the individual layers as you want. So people are really starting to, in this space, are starting to specialize on these things and really building out stuff. But I think they even, since it was Baselayer, it got sold to someone else now, but I can't remember what the new name of it is. Or it might still be named Baselayer, but I think someone else owns it. It's not the same people before. They sold the data center business to Iron Mountain, and then they sold the data center manufacturing business to another company, I believe. So it's a pretty interesting path that people are going down these days to get managed data center spaces in, you know, in various locations.
Yeah. Next announcement, I guess, was one more that Vlad shared also. AWS AppSync now supports JavaScript for all resolvers in GraphQL APIs. Can you relate the significance of this one?
Yeah, this was in preview for a while. So the idea is AppSync is giving you a GraphQL endpoint for a bunch of stuff in AWS. Like, you can put it in front of databases and a bunch of stuff. It's lovely. But if you wanted to use other resources, you either had to build a dedicated Lambda function, which is quite intense, or you could do the lightweight option, which was VTL, Velocity Template Language, the same thing you can also use for DynamoDB and a bunch of other stuff. And that wasn't the easiest thing to write, maintain, and understand, but it was super powerful. And now you can finally do JavaScript resolvers, which are easier to do. You don't have to deploy a full Lambda. They're faster. And for a lot of people, they hit the perfect compromise between power and maintenance. A lot of folks were really, really, really excited about this.
Sounds cool.
And I actually will point out, it says it in the article here too, but that AWS did the right thing. Not only did they ship like actual JavaScript support, but they tied into the rest of kind of the ecosystem. So they shipped a ESLint plugin to actually catch like things and, you know, errors early, like, so shift left, you don't have to compile and test all this stuff. And then the type validation for TypeScript, which is also really cool, because this helps you obviously make sure that you don't typo, like, you know, names of functions that you're calling and all of that kind of stuff in their SDK. They gave you a really good developer experience on top of just supporting JavaScript as well, which I thought was great.
Well, thanks for the context. Those are all the announcements we have. Any other announcements that we can get to today? All right, let's move over into Q&A. Any questions for today? Let me check the Slack. I haven't stayed on it yet. Mm. Okay. So David Lozano asks, hey, maybe someone can give me some feedback on this question on today's office hours. Can Atmos be managed, deployed by Spacelift? So what's really interesting about our approach on this, well, actually, before I get started, David, are you on the call still?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, cool. Yeah, so let me talk a little bit more about our approach that makes Atmos pretty unique. The TLDR is absolutely yes. We use it with dozens and dozens of customers every day. Hold on, my window, where'd it go? There it is. All right. So what we did is when we designed Atmos, so first of all, Atmos is an open source tool. It's a workflow automation tool. It's optimized to work with Terraform, but it supports any custom workflows and subcommands that you might want to have. For those who haven't been on office hours and seen some of my other demos, Atmos consumes configurations that are written in YAML. The easiest way to understand those configurations is they're somewhere in between like a Docker composition file, a Docker compose file, or or customize. Like if you're familiar with Kubernetes and how you can use customize to create your manifests and layer them on top of each other, that concept of inheritance there is built into Atmos. So what we do is in Atmos, we build up a data model of your infrastructure as configuration. And now since we have a data model for it, you can just use Terraform to read that data model and provision Spacelift. So we actually, that same configuration that you see is exactly the configuration that we use for deploying Spacelift itself. So it's built in two pieces. So we have a Terraform module here that is more generalized and takes data structures to provision things like, in this case, Spacelift stacks like this. So native Terraform code.
Yeah, I was going to say, we have a dedicated module now in there that specifically takes stack config and turns it into Spacelift stacks.
Oh, we did.
That bottom one, Spacelift stacks from Atmos config.
Oh, okay. Oh, all right, yeah. Cool. I didn't realize. Matt on the call actually helped us with the major refactor that we just did and cleaned up a lot of these things. But the gist of it is that Atmos was designed with the idea that we never want to break vanilla Terraform. So there are a lot of tools out there, Terraspace, Terramate, Terragrunt, and then some. But a lot of them aren't designed to work with vanilla Terraform so that you could just run it on the command line. Atmos, all we do is manage the TFVAR files. We're not doing code generation. There's one exception to this. We generate the backend file because Terraform itself doesn't support parameterizing that file. So, being honest on that one. But otherwise, first and foremost, we don't believe in code generation. So therefore, all the code that you use with Terraform, with Atmos and Terraform is vanilla Terraform code. So that's why it works with Spacelift. There are some things that we do to improve that experience, though, due to some limitations of Spacelift as a platform. So what we've written is, for example, a GitHub action. Now, this assumes you're using GitHub Actions, and it's not a requirement. But if you are using GitHub and GitHub Actions, then we have some actions to improve that implementation. So one is affected stacks. So this is a GitHub action that returns a list of affected stacks. And then we have a subsequent action that helps you call space that we use with Spacelift to trigger it. I'm getting into the weeds here, and I didn't do a good job explaining how that works. Matt here could explain it if it's interesting, but I want to pause and ask for a question for your feedback first. If there's anything more you want to add.
I was just going to answer one question from the chat. I was starting to type it, but I'll answer verbally now. So Someone in here asked, but Atmos is working like a wrapper for Terragrunt, a wrapper like Terragrunt does for Terraform, right? And I think the answer is yes and no. So yes, it is a wrapper just like Terragrunt is a wrapper, but Atmos does not break vanilla Terraform in the way that Terragrunt breaks using vanilla Terraform. You have to write Terragrunt friendly modules basically in order to, or root modules basically to, in order to use Terragrunt. Atmos basically just uses complete complete vanilla Terraform. So when you run Atmos Terraform plan and Atmos Terraform apply, under the hood, what happens is we take that YAML stack config, we deep merge it, and we extract out a vars file essentially, and then we dynamically pass that vars file just to Terraform, like generic Terraform under the hood. So we just say Terraform plan, here's the vars file, go do your thing, and then Terraform does all the heavy lifting from that part. So it's just a workflow that takes the YAML config, deep merges it, and generates var files under the, you know, as far as Terraform is concerned, and the dynamic generation of backends that Eric mentioned before. Those are really the two things that we do, you know, that are sort of unique. But you could do any of these steps yourself, or you can eject as from here, as Eric's showing on the screen. So if you start down the path with Atmos, you decide you don't want Atmos anymore, you can just run Atmos Terraform, generate var files, pass it which stack or stacks you want to generate those var files for, and you'll have independent var files that you can commit and, you know, and run any, you know, any way that you can run Terraform and pass the var file to it. So hopefully that answers your question.
So with this tool, with Atmos, it doesn't take care of putting the different modules together. I would have to take care of that, like get the different components and put them together, and then Atmos would be like generating the var files to inject to these modules, right?
I think I follow your question, but so in the way that Terragrunt downloads remote components and plans them on like on the fly, that isn't exactly the same way that that Atmos works. So Atmos components or root, you know, root modules essentially are on disk, and then it runs those, it generates those var files for them from the stack config. But we also do have some mechanisms within Atmos to help, like vendoring those from remote sources at a specific version as well. We just don't do it at runtime. We do it as a, you run the Atmos vendor command, and then it will pull that file down, and then you can plan or apply it. So hopefully that answered that part of your question.
Yep, I think that was a pretty, from my side, I think you covered everything, Matt. The key is that our components are all just, you don't have to use Cloud Posse components, by the way. We just, obviously we do this for customers, so we publish all those publicly. Those are at cloudposse.com/terraform-aws-components. But if you're just getting started and you want to kind of understand how to think about components and where to put them, this is a great place to look. We've taken a pretty opinionated way.
Sorry, just for context, a component for people who aren't using Atmos is a Terraform root module. We just call it a component.
Yeah. And okay. The reason why we call it a component is because Atmos isn't just for Terraform. So we support Helm file components. We support Terraform components. We want to add Docker components. The idea is that it is a way to consistently manage complex hierarchical configuration at scale for a company. So here's how we think about components, and we organize them by various types of services. A lot of companies will, for example, combine the VPC with the cluster inside of one component, inside of one Terraform root module. But in our opinion, that's an anti-pattern because that creates a snowflake architecture for Kubernetes. So instead, break things down into their core building blocks that you would ever want to reuse within your organization. Define sufficient level of parameters for each one of your components. That way they're very testable. That way, you know, they don't change themselves, and move your configuration via var files out of your Terraform code and manage your architecture as configuration. And that's really the secret sauce of what we do that makes things different from how a lot of companies manage Terraform. All right. So
thank you for the explanation.
Yeah, our pleasure. Any other questions we can help answer today?
Is there any new developments that you guys are aware of with the HashiCorp stuff since last week?
HashiCorp seems to be pretty much radio silence. If you go to HashiCorp's blog,
they've updated the FAQ a bunch of times, though.
I noticed they said the FAQ is binding.
Wait. Where did they say that?
They said they consider it. I think they said they consider it binding, which is just laughable.
It is hilarious. Because that's been my biggest complaint about this. The FAQ has become the license.
If only there were a way, like some kind of legal document.
I like that. Yeah. So now the license terms are as fungible as someone updating a web page, and you've agreed to that. Which version of it is binding? The first one they posted, the seventh one they posted, or the 12th one?
We asked about that, Matt. And they added dates recently, so they tell you when they last updated it, but they didn't go as far as giving you a version number. I'm like, this is version 1.0 or whatnot. Right. They tell you when it was last updated. There's been stuff, which is kind of
okay. Nice.
The interesting part is, like, so if I started doing this before you updated it to a term that said that I couldn't do it on that date, then that version that I was adhering to at the time is what is now legally binding. It's like, it's very complex.
They didn't say it was legally binding. They called it binding guidance.
Yeah, exactly.
I did ask them the question of, does binding guidance mean the same thing as a binding agreement? They did not. Obviously, they didn't want to answer that one, but they give us dates and a little bit of a change log, or not really, but
yeah. It's what a mess.
Has anybody heard of anyone from Hashi leaving, particularly like any core contributors or Terraform team members? Because I'm surprised by that. I would have expected like at least somebody to speak out and be like,
I can't speak for anybody in particular, but I've been in the understanding that I saw folks leaving over a year ago, and I think that they probably this probably was something that was planned out. So I think this contributed to those decisions, but that's speculation on my part, because I would hope that somebody says something more specific later. But I think that folks have been leaving for a little while now.
Yeah, I was going to say, I haven't heard of any developers, or maybe not even Terraform contributors specifically, but I have spoken directly with folks that work in product management, basically.
What's interesting is I didn't remember seeing including paid support arrangements, but that's an interesting nuance there, because they previously come out and said professional services, don't worry about it. but right. But professional services not for supporting. Well, if you combine professional services, but a paid support arrangement, now it starts to honestly feel like you're helping a company do GitOps with Terraform is competitive by this.
is that the evil HashiCorp monster?
That was scary.
Alex, you sound like you're talking through a blender.
All right, gonna.
That's great. Alex will be playing the part of HashiCorp in this discussion.
He's muted. But Alex is muted now. So, no, he's not again.
No, he's unmuted again. But it was, okay. I don't know. There's something wacky with his audio, obviously.
Yeah.
Probably check your microphone.
Sounds all right.
It's interesting that the few core contributors that have other than Mitchell, the people who have contributed kind of the most to the Terraform repository. If you go look at their commit histories, like their a lot of what they've done recently isn't particularly moving anything forward. It seems to be administrative type work, to make sure licenses are up to date and make sure some dependencies are up to date and merging a couple of internal things, but they don't seem to be doing any kind of community participation PRs recently.
Didn't work, Alex.
Yeah.
There is no Alex, only Zool.
So they changed this. They changed this last question, or added this last question, which was interesting to me. If you scroll up just like a quarter of an inch right there. No, the one that was on the bottom. I'm a consultant that helps my customers run their infrastructure using tooling. Read the first thing, all non-production use of HashiCorp products is permitted. So if you're doing that in a production, it's basically saying it's not permitted. And this is under the professional services license, thing. So
that's amazing. This is such a cluster. I didn't read those updates. I haven't seen this FAQ so deeply since getting back from vacation. amazing. I'd love to see them take us to court. ChatGPT
bot for this, so one can actually interact with it, maybe, and understand. If one's usage is,
I think it would break or go insane. It would hallucinate a lot more than regular ChatGPT because it seems like there's direct contradictions.
Yeah. You have to deploy it with CloudFront, though. Don't deploy it with Terraform.
Not for production use.
I don't know why I said CloudFront. I mean CloudFormation. my head went the wrong space. But
we've all done that 50 times. No worries.
I know. Too many things bouncing around in my brain.
It was interesting to see the digger fork has been taken down.
They announced that when they joined OpenTF, they basically, their intention was to join OpenTF, not to maintain their own fork themselves.
That's great. And I mean, I think we all kind of knew that because they're probably one of the smallest of the companies building on Terraform, but still, it's good to not not split it too many times too early.
Yeah.
I haven't heard of any other attempts or initiatives to do it other than the OpenTF. So I think there's been a pretty good collective movement here in getting behind one project.
Yeah. I was talking with my team about it earlier today, and Kevin on my team was skeptical that, you know, it would be able to keep feature parity. You know, that like, hey, Hashi devs are not going to be able, or are not going to quit, and they're going to keep, you know, building on a existing roadmap with existing product people, and how could a fork like keep up? And it seems so, so consolidated in terms of, you know, at what everybody is feeling. Like, you know, even if you're not a consulting company, or you're not a tooling vendor or whatever, everybody's kind of upset about this, right? The only people that I've heard say, like, in Hashi's favor, it's like, well, they're a company, they have the option to do this. Like we can't hold this against them or something. And it's like, that's not a great reason. And I don't know. I have faith in the community. If it does, get forked, that it would have some legs.
Yeah. I mean, I know your point that you just made, but you know, there are some pretty good examples. Like, I don't know, MariaDB is the first one that comes to mind. Like, has done a pretty damn good job since being forked. You know, that thing is, you know, I think we'd have that. I mean, that, I don't know. You probably, if you were on vacation, you probably weren't on the call last week, but we had some pretty in-depth like conversation about it. And I think the TLDR is that everyone kind of sees Terraform now as a language, and that's the distinguishing things. You can't take and host Terraform as an offering that competes with some, you know, a HashiCorp product. You can build something that competes with Terraform Enterprise, which is a cloud offering that does a bunch of things that was never open source. So they're basically trying to remove access to a language that they developed in, along with the community, and that the community has spent countless, you know, resources and hours also developing alongside them, trying to privatize the language so that you can't compete with their commercial offering that's built on top of the language. It's like saying, you know, anything that's built on top of C++ is now like copyrighted by, you know, AT&T Labs or whatever, or whoever, you know, whatever it is now. And they're going to try to put everyone out of business. I mean, it seems absolutely ridiculous to me that's the approach they've taken.
So, yeah. Google announced you're no longer allowed to use Golang to build search products.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or Kubernetes anything is now private.
Yeah. or anything that's written in Go that Google construes as competitive or maybe competitive in the future with Google is no longer like allowed. You know, that's probably an even better like example than the one I gave. I mean, that's how crazy this is right now. So.
Vlad, do you mind expanding on your comment? I'm interested to hear your thoughts.
I was going to ask the same.
Ideally, I wouldn't, but I'm trying to shut up. I cannot take OpenTF seriously. Like, they managed to do what I consider to be impossible, be even worse at business than HashiCorp, which, good job. So OpenTF started out nicely, like, yay, we're going to put the manifesto. Yay, companies are signing up. Like, it looked legit and it had a valid point. And then, in my personal opinion, it all went to shit. So if you look at the OpenTF manifesto that has so many signatories and so many companies and everybody's praising it, it's like 3.5 serious companies. Like, please. Like 50 of those companies are one-person companies, and every single goddamn consulting company or proof-of-concept Terraform Cloud competitor that has 2 employees. Oxide Company is supporting this. Yay, are you telling me they're going to allocate engineers to this? Come on. Like, it's grunt work, it's facelift, it's Cloud Posse, and a couple others. That's it.
And who would you want to see on there?
Let me finish. They saw that and they kept going away with, we're going to threaten HashiCorp, not we're going to collaborate with HashiCorp, we're going to talk with HashiCorp to figure out a way that we can both survive. Nothing. They just went full on aggressive instead of actually trying to find a way to collaborate. They don't understand. Based on what I'm seeing them communicate publicly, they don't understand that the OpenTF Foundation manifesto, whatever, thinks Terraform is just a GitHub repository and you just throw a couple of full-time engineers at it and that's it. Like, dude, that's not how this works. And even Cloud Posse, not to put you on the spot, Eric, like, yes, you want open source Terraform and la-di-da-di-da, and this is a big conviction and la-di-da-di-da. Awesome. Are you going to pay $500,000 a year in engineering time to not use Terraform? Like, are you that convinced?
Cloud Posse, for example, wouldn't be able to contribute the engineering, financial resources to do it. However, there is something to be said that these are startups, venture backed. They haven't exited yet. They're not backed by, we don't have any, Fortune 500 companies in this list, for example, standing behind it yet. I think that what's interesting, though, is, suspending judgment, if this is what they are able to come through with, 15 full-time engineers or full-time employees, maybe not engineers, to be clear.
Yeah, 13, right there.
No, 13, yeah. Thank you. Let's assume they were developers, though. When you compare that with the number of HashiCorp people committed to Terraform, I see it as feasible that this is something that can be done.
And 10 engineers can rewrite Google from scratch. It's not just code and commits in a GitHub repository. It's roadmap planning. It's discussing with cloud providers. It's collaborating with partners. The junior engineer notion that, oh my God, I'm just going to throw more developers at it. Like, no, dude, you need project managers. You need roadmap planning. You need a lot. You need community management. Like, look at how many issues are there. Are the 13 engineers?